You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
On Wednesday, November 18th, the Special Committee on the Canadian Mission in Afghanistan heard testimony from high-ranking diplomat Richard Colvin. Colvin was second in command at Canada's Kabul embassy in 2006 and 2007. In his testimony, Colvin said he repeatedly raised concerns about the abuse of Afghan detainees transferred by Canadian forces to the Afghan authorities. He testified that his memos were mostly ignored for a year, then he was told by government officials to keep quiet and to express his concerns by telephone rather than put them on paper. The BC Civil Liberties Association and Amnesty International first started raising concerns about the treatment of Afghan detainees in 2002, right after Canada invaded Afghanistan. In 2007, the two organizations filed a lawsuit seeking charter protection for detainees. They also have a complaint before the Military Police Complaints Commission. Grace Pastine is litigation director with the BC Civil Liberties Association. She joins me by phone this morning from Vancouver. Good morning, Grace, and welcome to Co-op Radio.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
What were the grounds for the lawsuit you filed in 2007?
Our organizations at that time were very concerned that Canadian forces were apprehending detainees and were transferring those detainees over to a substantial risk of torture when they were handed over to Afghan officials. What we argued in our lawsuit was that charter protections should apply to the charter should apply to the activities of the Canadian forces stationed abroad. That is, that that the charter follows our soldiers when they go abroad, and that our men and women in the armed forces are not only beholden to our international agreements that prevent torture and prevent complicity in torture, but also to our domestic charter protections. So that's why we filed the lawsuit.
And I gather through that case that you were able to gain access to thousands of documents.
That's right. As part of the disclosure in the lawsuit, the government provided us with many documents that were shed a lot of light on the situation in Afghanistan. Now, you have to keep in mind that when we first filed our lawsuit, there was a real dearth of information. I mean, there still is a dearth of information. But at the time, what we were really relying on was reports of non-governmental organizations working in Afghanistan, reports of the UN Secretary General, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, even the US State Department. And all these reputable bodies were saying that torture was being committed by Afghan authorities and that it was common and very routine. So we had this basic background information, but it wasn't until we filed our lawsuit that we started to receive government documents.
The federal court, I gather, though, rejected the case and said the charter didn't apply.
That's right. In what was a setback for our organizations, the federal court said that the charter doesn't apply extraterritorially and that there really weren't any domestic remedies to constrain the activities of Canadian forces in Afghanistan. And that central finding was also upheld by the Federal Court of Appeal. But what the trial court said was also that the allegations of torture were believable and credible. And so we saw that our federal court case as being a partial win. What the judge in the federal court said was that there were many credible complaints of prisoner abuse, and that this raised grave concerns about the activities of Canadian forces. So a lot of what the federal court said very nicely corroborates Mr. Colvin's testimony.
So taking that into account, you have the what the federal court said. You had evidence, as you say, from many other agencies about abuse and torture. Why then is Colvin's testimony so significant?
Well, in some ways, Colvin's testimony did not come as a surprise at all to our organizations. And so we really question why it comes as a surprise to the Canadian government. What is noteworthy about what Mr. Colvin has said in these last weeks is that, for one thing, he was sending off reports for a number of years and to a wide variety of government and military officials. We weren't aware of just how widely his reports were disseminated. Also, the picture he paints of torture is much worse than our organizations thought. We were quite convinced that prisoners were being transferred to a substantial likelihood of torture. But what Mr. Colvin said is that he thought that virtually every prisoner, in fact, all prisoners, were tortured once they were handed over to Afghan security forces. And then finally, the number of people that have been transferred appears to be much higher than what we thought. We've always thought that perhaps 100 individuals were transferred. It now seems like perhaps upwards of 500 have been transferred.
Do we have more precise information about who these Afghan people are who are being transferred?
Yes, that is another important point that has come across in Mr. Colvin's testimony. He has stated that although some of the people that have been captured by Canadian forces are no doubt high-level targets, a vast number of them are simply people that happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, farmers, villagers, truck drivers, certainly not the dangerous Taliban insurgents.
Canada had signed two agreements with Afghan authorities relating to the treatment of people captured by Canadian soldiers. And what do we know about those agreements?
The first agreement that Canada entered into was with Afghanistan was entered into in December of 2005. That agreement was a very sort of bare-bones agreement, and it's essentially just set out that once Canadian forces apprehended prisoners, that they would then hand those detainees over to Afghan security forces, and that Afghanistan would promise that those prisoners wouldn't be subject to the death penalty. It was a very bare-bones agreement. It didn't provide for any sort of monitoring or follow-up. Under that first agreement, Canadian forces had essentially no idea where people were going and kept no record of even of their names. That agreement continued for some time. We filed our lawsuit in February of 2007. In May 3rd, 2007, Canada entered into the second agreement with Afghan officials, and that agreement provided for more monitoring. It was slightly more robust, but in the view of our organizations, there are still many problems with this second agreement, and it's under this agreement that prisoners are currently being transferred, and that agreement just simply does not provide for adequate protections. And we have grave concerns that prisoners, detainees, are still being handed over to torture.
It now seems to have come to the fore as well that the transfer agreements, however inadequate they were also suspended periodically. What does that mean? What was the significance of that?
Well, it's very significant that Canada was temporarily halting transfers because it suggests, and in fact we now know, that the reason why transfers were stopped periodically was because Canada itself had grave concerns about the treatment of detainees once they were handed over to Afghan authorities. Now, it's important to keep in mind and to remember that for some time, those transfers were secretly stopped. Canada never publicly announced that those transfers were being stopped until our organizations filed a lawsuit in federal court. And it was literally the morning of when our lawsuit was set to proceed that Canada announced that, in fact, the lawsuit was moot because transfers were no longer going on. We've subsequently learned that Canada not only secretly stopped transfers in 2007, but a number of times in 2009 and in other periods as well. And we are very interested to know what exactly caused Canadian forces to stop those transfers, what sort of high-level discussions were going on, what information was available to the government, and finally, why none of that has never been made public to the Canadian people.
There's agreement both by Colvin himself and by his superior Mulroney that he filed numerous detailed reports. Have you been able to read any of the reports that Richard Colvin provided to the Canadian government about what he says was happening to detainees?
Yes, I have. And in fact, our organizations now, I believe, have a complete copy of all the reports that he filed in Afghanistan. These were made available to us through the Military Police Complaints Commission, and we are presently under an undertaking not to disclose those or to discuss the contents of those with anyone. So I'm not at liberty to discuss what's in those, but we are seeking permission from the Commission to be released from our undertaking so that we can share and discuss those documents.
And you say complete, that is not censored?
No, I'm sorry. I should add in that they are heavily redacted.
What's your reaction to the attempts by the Government of Canada and the military to discredit Richard Colvin and his testimony?
We think that it's shameful. It's very clear that Richard Colvin was a respected, high-level diplomat, that he has been acting completely within his sphere of responsibility, that he endeavored to make his reports known to the chain of command, and that he has come forward as a public servant because he feels as though he has a duty to Canada and the Canadian people, which he does, and has done so honorably. So we think it is absolutely shameful that the government is seeking to discredit him.
It seems from the transcripts of the hearing where Colvin testified that the questioning by members of parliament on the committee proceeded along very partisan lines. Is this a partisan issue?
It has become a partisan issue, but this certainly goes beyond liberals and conservatives. Keep in mind that it wasn't a conservative government that entered into the first transfer agreement. It's unfortunate now that it is so partisan, and this is one of the reasons why our organizations are calling for a public inquiry. We think that we really need a neutral, impartial body that is somewhat outside or completely outside the fray of politics, to fully investigate this issue. That will really only be that's the only way that the Canadian public's confidence in its officials and in institutions can be restored.
We mentioned earlier that you had a complaint filed with Amnesty and yourself, I believe, both organizations, with the Military Police Complaints Commission, because it's actually the military police who are the ones doing the transfer. Has there been any progress at all on that front?
Unfortunately, there has not been a lot of progress on that front. The Military Police Complaints Commission decided that our complaints needed to be thoroughly investigated and that full hearings needed to be held into the matter. And we really welcomed that decision. We'd been stymied in the federal courts, and we saw that then as a real opportunity to get the truth out and to explore the issue. Unfortunately, the Canadian government has been incredibly reluctant to release any documents to the commission. And on the basis that the Canadian government has taken the position that virtually every document in its possession is subject to national security concerns and that therefore cannot be handed over and can't be publicly disseminated in any way. The commissioner of the Military Police Complaints Commission decided that because there was an absolute paucity of documents that the hearings would have to be adjourned. So that happened recently, and the hearings are currently adjourned probably at least for 6 months, but at this point in time, it's really uncertain whether they will proceed. They cannot proceed unless Canada makes information available.
While all these hearings are going on, are transfers still happening?
Yes, they are. We don't know how many, and we don't know who, but we know that they are going on. Unless, of course, Canada can secretly stop transfers for periods, and we have no way of knowing if they've secretly stopped now, but it seems very likely that they are continuing.
So as you said earlier, a full public inquiry is the way we need to go if we really want to find out what is happening and who's responsible.
Yes, public inquiries are really uniquely positioned to address openly and objectively matters of substantial public importance. And this is a very important issue. Public inquiries can take a long-term view. They can interview, they can hear testimony from witnesses, they have the resources to review large volumes of documents. They are really uniquely situated to investigate exactly these types of situations. And they, by having this thorough and impartial investigation, they are really able to restore public confidence in government institutions when it's been shaken. And public confidence has certainly been shaken here.
Well, thank you very, very much, Grace. Much appreciated.
Thank you, and thank you for covering the issue.
I've been speaking with Grace Pasteen. She is litigation director with the BC Civil Liberties Association.